So hello and welcome to the LSE's International Inequalities Institute, or more accurately, my loft. But thank you for coming virtually to this event held by the LSE. My name's Neil Lee. I'm a professor of economic geography at the LSE and an associate of the International Inequalities Institute. It is a very topical theme, today's event, and we're very excited about it. The COVID pandemic has led to a massive economic and social shock, probably the biggest shock of everyone's lifetimes. And the impact has been highly unequal. It's been unequal across countries, across cities, across industries, by age and by ethnicity. Now, some people have suggested that it will lead to the death of the successful megacities, cities such as London, Toronto, Paris, which have become increasingly important parts of the world economy. And today, we're going to be talking about these issues. Will the pandemic exacerbate disparities between the richest and poorest cities? Will it lead to an exodus of the most affluent people from cities, stranding less well-paid service workers without jobs? What are the long-term implications of the pandemic going to be for the future of cities? So we're going to be interrogating those questions today, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by four of the leading experts on this topic. First up, we're going to hear from Dr. Shauna Braille. Shauna is Associate Professor at the Institute for Management and Innovation at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. One of the world's leading experts, I particularly recommend her work on the platform economy and how it applies to cities and is changing cities. Her work on unicorns is very well worth reading. Following that, we have Dr. Max Nathan. Max is an Associate Professor in Applied Urban Sciences at UCL, and he's also Deputy Director of the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth. Now, Max is an interesting academic because if you drew a Venn diagram between sort of hardcore econometrics and then hipster urbanism, Max would be somewhere in the middle. So we're very pleased to have him here. He's published a great paper with Henry Overman looking at the issues we will be discussing today. And he's also, I'm pleased to say, LSE alumni. Our next speaker, Valentin Quinio, is also LSE alumni. She's a rising star at the Centre for Cities. So the Centre for Cities is probably the UK's most influential urban think tank, an organisation with which we have a very close relationship. And finally, last but not least, we have Professor Michael Storper. Professor Michael Storper has a wonderful paper on this topic, which is out, which he'll be talking about today. He's an incredibly eminent academic, but I'm particularly pleased to have him here. Because he's also the most cosmopolitan person I know. And to sort of illustrate this, he's a professor at Sciences Po in Paris, UCLA in LA, and the LSE in London. So if anyone can tell us something about cities, it's Michael. So we have these four wonderful speakers. This is how it's going to work. Each speaker gets their 10 minutes. Then I'm going to turn to questions. It's a sort of loose 10 minutes. They're going to be giving short presentations. Then we're going to have questions which you guys can post into the chat. We'll hopefully leave plenty of time for questions because, you know, this is a topical issue. You will all have opinions and feel free to sort of, you know, disagree with our disagree with everything which is said today. I have to make two final shameless plugs before I hand over to Shauna. The first is that this is not our final event of, well, this is not our final event of 2020. 2020 is going to continue even further for even longer period. So we have the Migration, Ethnicity and Race Seminar tomorrow, entitled Does Selection Matter? Immigrant Selectivity, Skills and Class Habitus. That's tomorrow 1 p.m. GMT with René Reichel-Luthra from the University of Essex. And we also have the final event this term is the report of the UK Wealth Tax Commission on Wednesday the 9th December from 4 till 5:30 GMT. And there's going to be a link in the chat function for more information. So now I'm going to hand over to our first speaker, Shauna. Thank you very much.
Neil, thank you very much for the invitation to participate. I believe I'm sharing my screen, so I just guess. Thank you, Max. It's a pleasure to be a part of this panel today. We're now about 9 months into this pandemic, and it's horrible. It's turned so many people's worlds completely upside down. Global deaths exceed 1.5 million people. In the city of Toronto, where I'm sitting today, we've had more than 1,600 deaths. Millions of lives have been lost. billions of lives upended. We can't forget the really tragic public health consequences, especially as we sit today in our very warm homes with, in fact, the privilege of being on Zoom, even though most of us are quite sick of it by now. While preparing my remarks for today's session, I was thinking back to the very first signs that COVID was going to be something more than a problem that affected somewhere else. When I was first asked to stay home from work because I had recently traveled to the US, the first time I saw somebody in a grocery store wearing a mask in Toronto, which was unheard of 10 months ago, how strange it was to be searching all over for hand sanitizer, and how we made fun of ourselves for not even knowing what day it was anymore. We cheered at night for our frontline workers, and we wondered when it would all end. And there was just so much unknown about COVID, how it spread, who was most at risk, what the impacts would be. One of the very first things that we were told, though, was about the three C's: avoid things like crowded places, closed spaces, and close contact. And as an urbanist and someone who studies cities, my first reaction was, what about the fourth C, cities? And we know COVID is undoubtedly going to change cities both at the intra and interurban scales. And we also know that there, before the pandemic, there were great inequities in cities. And what's happened essentially, it looks like, is that the pandemic has made a lot of people worse off. It has exacerbated inequalities. And yet it gives us this opportunity to take a look and say, how can we make things better? What are the sort of interventions that we can make, the policy interventions, the funding interventions, the changes in practices that actually leave us better off? Because at the very end, and I'll give you the conclusion now, but cities aren't going anywhere, particularly our large global cities. And we can discuss and debate that afterwards too, and I look forward to that. Our original focus when we talked about COVID, and the slides that I'm sharing and the data I'm sharing, this data is from the City of Toronto's COVID dashboard. Dashboards have become really a hugely critical source of information and detail about understanding the pandemic and understanding the impacts and challenges. And in fact, I'll also show you a dashboard project that I've been working on, looking at sort of economic and urban vibrancy during the pandemic. But we first thought that the focus had to be on the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. There was very little talk of race or income at the intra-urban level. And yet we now know, thanks to a collection of a range of data, which we didn't actually have at the very beginning, that the spread of the virus, as well as the economic impacts, are very highly racialized and tied to both income and geography within cities. So this graphic here shows us actually that despite the fact that the Black population in Toronto comprises 9% of our total population, they represent 20% of COVID cases. So people of South Asian and Indo-Caribbean descent represent 13% of the city and 21% of the cases, and white people represent 48% of the city's population, but only 23% of COVID cases. We see similar kinds of trends in terms of household income. So for household incomes below $30,000 and below $50,000 in the City of Toronto, we see a very, you know, these households represent 14 and 15% of total households, but they represent 24% or 48% combined of total COVID cases in the city. Whereas if we go to the highest income households, the households earning $150,000 or more, we see these households represent only 8%. Of COVID cases. And finally, when we look to the intra-urban geography of COVID, this map here, actually the darker blue zones show us the highest incidences of COVID cases in the northeast and northwest sectors of the city. This is our city's downtown. The highest incidence of cases happens to coincide with the highest proportions of both racialized and low-income populations. And it's not because there is a higher, you know, it's not because they're white, they're Black or brown that they're getting COVID. It's because there are more crowded living conditions in these places. It's because people who live here and work in the core are more reliant on public transit, they're lower income, they're less likely to own a private vehicle. They may work in frontline jobs that simply can't be done remotely. About a quarter to a half of jobs can do some part remotely, but there are many jobs that simply can't be done remotely. And this is where we're seeing the sort of the greatest kinds of challenge and risk and problem, but also these are issues we knew about before, and we know about them even more now. And it's incumbent on cities, on policymakers, on leaders to use the pandemic as a way to address these with greater urgency and with greater effect. At the time of the lockdown, we started to see other kinds of data being released. This shows mobility trends in Toronto. This is actually from a project I'm working on called TorontoAfterTheFirstWave.com. And here we see the absolute dive in all kinds of mobility in the city. And Toronto looks a lot like every other large global city and most other cities as the pandemic began to hit and as lockdowns took place, where all kinds of mobility, driving in orange, transit in gray, and walking in red, all just essentially fell off a cliff. But unlike driving and walking, which returned sort of at greater speed, we see tremendous impacts on reduced ridership in public transit, which also created an immediate and urgent crisis for cities because public transit agencies tend to be run by municipal governments, particularly cities with subways are losing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on an annual basis as a result of the loss of transit riders. And this is having a really significant fiscal impact on municipal finances. If we look at business disruptions, we also see terrific unevenness in economic impact. I was looking this morning at the market value of tech firms, which I'm very interested in. Their value has skyrocketed during the pandemic. Amazon's market cap went from $841 billion on March 16th to $1.58 trillion today. Google, $744 billion to $1.25 trillion. Shopify, one of the largest Canadian e-commerce companies, went from $40 billion to $163 billion. Airbnb and Lime both were profitable in the last quarter, despite this kind of call that the platform economy would see its end as a result of the pandemic. Anything but that is true. And yet at the same time, if we look at things like, you know, small businesses, sales have taken a real dive. Bankruptcies are down, but so are business license renewals and new business licenses. And so what this says to me is that we haven't yet seen the full impact of the pandemic, particularly on local economies and on local firms. And so while we see here that in fact some government subsidies and funds and programs are actually having a positive effect by reducing the total number of bankruptcies to below where we would expect them to be even on a regular year, we see there's less business formation that we would also anticipate. In terms of jobs, and this actually isn't on our Toronto After the First Wave website yet because we're still building it. It's a tool that scrapes LinkedIn for jobs data. But again, what we see here is that professional jobs in the red have returned much more rapidly than jobs in food, for instance, which we expect to go down as our restaurants no longer have indoor or outdoor dining in Toronto. Our stores have been closed, so we can expect retail to go down. And the other piece about the jobs data is that the higher income earners are doing well, if not better than before, whereas the lower income earners are worse off. The jobs recovery is also a recovery that in which women are at a disadvantage, a significant disadvantage. They lost more jobs and they have more to recover, and lower income earners lost more jobs and have more to recover. On the question of, you know, does COVID spell the end of cities? Well, if you look at the media from New York and London and Toronto and elsewhere, you know, big questions. Does COVID spell the end of urban density? Will public life vanish? How much are rents falling? We know they're falling. How far can they fall? Will they recover? Is everyone fleeing to the suburbs? And can city life survive coronavirus? And so I would end with a resounding yes, city life can survive coronavirus. We know that there are really difficult times ahead, there will be, and there's expected to be a lot of economic and social scarring on cities and on people. And we also know that cities are the places where innovation takes root. We can see from this image, this is a picture of a public art exhibit that was put on in Toronto in the downtown core about a month or two ago, finding new ways to sort of engage, new ways to share, and new ways to interact, and also new ways to create hope. So I'll end by saying that, you know, as someone who studies cities, I like to say the car and the highway didn't spell the end of cities. The internet didn't spell the end of cities. I mean, everyone expected that these would. Coronavirus also does not spell the end of the city. Thank you.
Shauna, that was wonderful. Thank you very much. So our next up is Max.
Thank you, Shauna. That was really fantastic talk. And I'm gonna echo quite a lot of what you say, I think. I'm going to do a little bit of scene setting, and then there's going to be quite a lot of, I hope, fairly structured speculation about the future of cities. And as Neil said, a lot of that's going to build on this piece that Henry Overman and I wrote back in September, I think, which has just come out in a journal. So I want to start by just trying to kind of frame the public conversation about cities a little bit. And this builds very much off Shauna's slide. I mean, I see two, you know, quite polarized takes on all of this. One is this kind of end of cities agenda, or sort of, you know, end of cities take, which is, you know, more or less apocalyptic descriptions of the end of large urban cores, particularly kind of global cities like London. So this Alistair Heath piece here is probably my favourite example of that form. The other type of conversation I've seen a lot of is this kind of is a post-COVID framing, which is much more nuanced and, you know, talks in with much more kind of granularity about where cities are going. I think both of these are kind of unhelpful in different ways, and I'm gonna try and talk about why I think that is. Before I do that, I wanna kind of, you know, jump down and reprise some of what Shauna was saying about, you know, the impacts of the pandemic, you know, as they've actually been, as opposed to kind of future, speculating about the future. One of the things that's sort of really struck me in kind of looking through some of the data on this is that, you know, back in the spring, back in March in particular, a lot of the conversation about cities was about whether this is about kind of big cities and density, basically. And what you can see if you kind of, at least for the UK, if you kind of plot the data, so here on these two graphs, we've got kind of cumulative case rates on here and population density on here. You can see a pretty strong positive relationship in March as the first wave is unfolding. And it basically goes away, apart from for mid-sized cities, by the end of October. So that relationship weakens. But then if you plot cases against deprivation, it's kind of flat at the beginning and then gets increasingly stronger over time. And very much as Shauna was saying, you know, this isn't causal, but we have a pile of evidence building all the time that it's, you know, people in these poorer neighborhoods, in poorer cities and poorer places in cities, who are more exposed in the type of work they do, are less able to kind of socially distance in their home environments. They may have worse health overall. And there's a particular intersection, at least in the UK, with people in kind of Black and ethnic minority communities. So this is a pandemic that's kind of reproduced a lot of inequalities that were already there. And I think it's important to kind of bear that in mind. So given all of that, we're now at potentially a, you know, an inflection point where we have effective vaccines and, you know, at least in the UK, we're starting to distribute them. So, you know, we might think that this means all the kind of future of cities conversation basically goes away, and by the middle of next year, we're kind of back to normal. I would certainly say the kind of end of cities take is looking a lot less favorable than it was, you know, back in the middle of the year. It's clearly, I think we're clearly less likely to see, you know, immediate, radical, disruptive change of the kind that some of those commentators have suggested, at least for now. Having said that, there are these, you know, longer term drivers of change, some of which were there before coronavirus, but, you know, the pandemic has kind of shifted them in ways which are quite interesting. And I think these are the things that we need to look out for. So the first, as, you know, Shauna showed in her talk, is the economic damage that the pandemic has caused, which is vast. And I think what we have to worry about is the type of kind of recession and recovery that different countries and locations are going to have. So is it going to be a kind of V-shaped thing, which takes everyone with us, or is it going to be more K-shaped, where particular places and groups might be left behind? I mean, linked to that is the set of forced experiments that we're, you know, have been going through and all are going through in one way or another. To the extent that those disruptions become new norms, it influences what kind of jobs are going to come back and in what form and where that's going to happen. And then a kind of broader issue, I think, is what I call pandemic risk. So, you know, we know now, if we didn't know beforehand, that being in a big global city like London makes you vulnerable to globalized pandemics. And, you know, we'd be very lucky in quote Western countries that we, you know, haven't had to deal with this for decades. If you're in a, you know, an East Asian city, you're going to have much more recent experience of this. But, you know, now that awareness of risk is much more sort of well understood, that's another driver on, you know, the way that households and firms might organize themselves in a way that is still to play out, I think. And that also relates to the way that different countries' governments and institutions and leaders have dealt with this. So if you're in a country which has not handled the pandemic well and where institutions have not held up particularly well, I think that's going to affect your confidence about how you might deal with future pandemics when they come along and what you might think of some of the experimentation that we've gone through. So the biggest forced experiment, I think, or at least the one that has, you know, affected a large number of people doing, you know, doing work like this panel, is a working from home experiment. Now, as Shauna mentioned, only a minority of jobs can be done from home. In the UK, the figure's about 44%, I think. What has happened in a very short order is the kind of closing of the working from home gap. So pre-lockdown, only about 6% of the UK workforce had ever worked at home. And by the middle of this year, we basically kind of reached capacity. And that's a share that's going to be quite a lot higher in cities, particularly bigger cities like London. So that's a kind of lower, you know, a lower bound on the number. Now, how much of that is going to stick around, I think, depends partly on whether you look at the statics or the dynamics. So, you know, if you look at surveys of employers, they seem pretty happy with the transition to working from home. I mean, many of their employees, I think, would disagree with that. But you can take an organization, an existing set of work relationships, and kind of shift it to remote working, and it seems to be broadly okay. And we also have, you know, studies from sort of pre-pandemic times which suggest that you can have, you know, just as effective teams working remotely as sort of face-to-face if those teams already know each other. I think it gets much harder when you think about the dynamic parts of economic activity. So thinking about, you know, starting up a new company, how to do kind of chance interactions, how to generate new ideas. Those kind of things which drive innovation and drive productivity seem much harder to do with the remote working tools we have, but they're things which cities are very good at helping us do, particularly if you're a younger worker who doesn't have a bunch of networks and a bunch of experience which you can just port online. And I think that raises a kind of bigger issue about what happens to urban economies and urban growth if we have a big shift to working from home. So this is a question of kind of private versus social benefits. If working from home is kind of good enough for individual firms to do it, there's a collective loss from sort of losing urban proximity, which will have potentially quite a big impact on urban economic growth over the longer term. And that, I think, is something to worry about. Now, those kind of micro decisions then kind of shift up to where all of this stuff happens. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves here, and I don't have an answer to this, by the way, is whether this is a shift within cities, so from kind of city centres to suburbs, or whether it's a shift across the whole urban system, so from kind of bigger cities to smaller cities. Now, you know, as Shauna and I think are agreeing, we don't think any of this is going to happen anytime soon. On the other hand, I think, you know, it's worth thinking about what some of these dimensions might be. So one is thinking about what might be happening in city centres. So the kind of working from home experiment is clearly triggering a lot of experimentation in how office work and sort of office jobs are organised. And I think that will continue. I think that the tougher questions are about whether firms then start to concentrate activities in fewer places and which places those are, and whether those are sort of places in the quote home country or not. So if we can, you know, organize work remotely and have face-to-face in fewer places, we might start shifting work across time zones as well, rather more than we have done already. And that, I think, is a kind of unsettling prospect for city leaders. There are also obvious implications for, you know, local retail and local services. So we talk a lot about the Pret economy in the UK, since, you know, Pret a Manger is a sort of iconic thing. It's a company that has already pivoted to offering Pret dinners, which will be, you know, delivered to your home by Uber Eats and Deliveroo. So there's a real question, I think, about, whether that kind of activity is going to shift kind of one-to-one from where office workers were or are to some future set of office worker locations. So whether it will just kind of go from city centres to sort of suburban residential neighbourhoods, and how much of it can kind of shift online and stay online. And that very much applies, I think, to retail. I think there are harder questions for the kind of leisure activities or sort of evening economy activities that are basically based on face-to-face interaction. And then the final part of this is about housing and housing market. So we know that, at least in the UK, it's higher paid workers, kind of older, richer people, who are most likely to have these working from home jobs. So there is a kind of inequality in the distribution of those opportunities. Now, in the UK, we don't build enough housing, we certainly don't build enough affordable housing to allow for large population movements of the kind that sort of end of cities people argued might happen. So to the extent that we do see moves, they're going to be moves by older, richer people to desirable towns and suburbs, which will make those places pricier. Now, I haven't yet seen any strong evidence of mass exodus from cities. I mean, there are some studies that suggest small movements, but nothing like the type that's been envisaged. On the other hand, to the extent that we see these shifts over the longer term, this will be the opposite of levelling up. It will be more spatial segregation, not evening out economic activity. And so there's a few sort of final thoughts. The first is that this is unlikely to be the last global pandemic we face. I think for that reason, post-COVID framing may not be the most helpful way of sort of thinking about this, or kind of post-pandemic framing. Susan Parnell talks about making cities pandemic resilient, and I think that may be a more useful starting point for policymakers when we're thinking about not only kind of public health, but some of the broader social and kind of economic policy tools that we might need. I think this kind of end of city scenario that we heard a lot about this year now seems very much less likely. If we were 4 or 5 years into the pandemic and the vaccine were only arriving now, it would be a different story, but we seem to be on a kind of exit soon scenario, assuming that, you know, this stuff works and can be rolled out quickly. But these forces of change that I mentioned are still going on in the background. You know, absent policy interventions, they may deepen urban inequalities rather than level them up. And even if all they do is kind of accelerate trends that were already there, this is not going back to normal. It's, you know, speeding up on a pathway which we were already on, which we may, you know, where we might not have actually noticed the extent of change, where we might now notice it sooner than we thought. And on that unsettling note, let me finish it. Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you very much. Next up, Valentin.
Thank you. So I thought I would talk you through some of the research we've been doing at the Centre for Cities in the past few months. There's a lot to talk about when we talk about the future of cities, but to get there, I think I will look at how cities in the UK have experienced this crisis, and city centres in particular, and then I'll dwell on the consequences for urban labour markets and then inequalities both within and between cities. And one thing we did in terms of research is to look at footfall data, where footfall is defined as pedestrian activity. And we looked at how it evolved from a pre-pandemic situation to throughout the lockdown and after the first lockdown. And the reason why we looked at city centres specifically is because despite representing a tiny proportion of land, just 0.1% of land in the UK, they concentrate most jobs and most office jobs in the country. And so when we speak about the future of work from home, we mostly talk about city centres, even though there's also loads of interesting things to talk about on the future of suburbs, for instance. And we've talked a lot about the hollowing out of city centres as if it was a phenomenon which was affecting every high street equally. But what the data shows, perhaps unsurprisingly, is that it's not the case. And so the main story from our research is that cities have coped differently with the pandemic, and small and medium-sized cities are recovering much faster than London and large cities more generally. And this is what you can see here on this first chart, which looks at footfall recovery. So this compares footfall over time compared to pre-lockdown levels. And what it says is, two things. First, it tells you that although all cities have experienced a significant drop in footfall when lockdown started, London fell much further down than small cities, for instance, which is in purple here. And then related to that, when restrictions were released earlier in the summer, you see that recovery jumped much faster here for small cities. And in London, the trend remained quite flat. And so at the end of September, just before the second lockdown started, London was around just above 20% recovery in terms of activity, compared to somewhere between 80 and 90%. For larger cities, so it's quite a marked contrast. And the reason for this is obviously work from home. And when we speak about work from home, we often talk about differences within cities, but actually because cities have a very different sectorial and industrial specialization, they have a very different share of their population who can work from home. And this is where you can see here on this chart, which looks at the link between the recovery in terms of footfall on the y-axis here, and the estimate share of workers able to work from home. And you see here there's a really positive relationship between the two. But you also see that the extent of the difference in terms of, if you compare London or Oxford, which have more than 40% of their workers who can work from home, compared to somewhere between 18 and 20 in Mansfield and Barnsley, which is quite a big difference. And this obviously is not an issue in itself, but the problem is that it's having a knock-on impact on local services and retail and hospitality. And this is what we can see here. This crisis has had a very unequal impact on urban labor markets. And work from home puts already precarious jobs at risk. So this chart here looks at the same link between, the same data from footfall recovery here, but it looks at the link with job postings in local services here and the difference between 2020 and 2019. And so what it tells us is that the places which have seen the biggest drop in footfall have also seen a really marked decrease in job posting in these local services, and that compares to places here in the top right corner where footfall didn't go that much further down, and so there's a much smaller difference in terms of job postings. Now I think there's an interesting thing to say here about inequalities, because we may read this chart and think, okay, but then does that mean that this crisis is in a way leveling down the country by itself, because you're more likely to find a job as a bartender in Birkenhead here, for instance, which is in the north of the country, for those of you who are not familiar with the UK geography, compared to London. Well, that's not really the case. And the reason for this is because we're talking about a relative recovery to a situation which in many of these places here in the top right corner was quite difficult before the crisis. And so a recovery to a situation which was quite precarious is not a real recovery, and it's definitely not leveling up. So I have a few statistics here to back this up. So if you look at Doncaster, for instance, which is here on the chart, Doncaster before the crisis had an over-reliance on retail, which is at the moment and has been for a long time threatened by the rise of online shopping, and also had an 18% vacancy rate on its high street. And that compares to, let's look at Oxford, which is here more in the bottom left. Before the crisis, Oxford had already made the change from retail, or the shift from retail to food and drink amenities. And Oxford only had an 8% vacancy rate. So the interesting thing from this data is that we're almost reaching a paradoxical situation where the places here which have seemingly suffered the least from the crisis actually face the longest or the toughest long-term challenges, compared to places here where indeed workers are key, workers coming back are key for the recovery, but in a way it will only take workers to come back to fully bounce back to pre-lockdown levels of activity, compared to places here where policies are needed to narrow down inter-urban inequalities. So we've said that in places like London, for instance, it will take workers to come back to bounce back to pre-lockdown levels. So let's zoom in London to see what exactly that means and what the scale of the challenge is. So in the very short term, it looks like inter-urban inequality is reduced. And that is because at the moment, the gap between London and the rest of the country and the north of the country in particular has narrowed down. And that's because in London, unemployment benefit claims have risen sharply since March. So London, which was in quite a successful situation before the crisis, is now facing hardship. And London represents now 20% of all UK claimants in terms of unemployment benefits. But then instead of being a story of leveling down, I suppose it's more something that has to do with the polarization. And that's because when you look at London labour market, London is also home to 33% of jobs in low furloughing sectors. So these are jobs in financial industries or managerial professions, for instance, which have been quite sheltered from the crisis. But then these jobs represent, well, the fact that these jobs are now being done from home represent 65% fewer potential customers for hospitality and retail, for instance. And that puts almost half a million jobs at risk in retail, in arts and hospitality. So that gives you an idea of the scale of the challenge. And so the question for London is, how long does it take for workers to come back if they do? And I'd be more than happy to discuss later on predictions for the return of workers in the office. And I just wanted to finish by a final thought, which I think sets important foundations for discussion. We've often been talking about the future of the city, mostly with a focus on its role as a place of work. But I guess the interesting question is, what is really the alternative to cities? And as much as we've all been able, more or less successfully, to transfer our work patterns inside our homes, I guess none of us have really found any alternative for socializing and having fun and the whole leisure aspect of living in a city. And more than that, we've not really found any alternative. And so this is what is shown in this chart here, which looks at footfall data. So the same data as before, but this time with the breakdown for workers here in purple, and then nighttime activity and weekend activity. And what it tells us is that indeed, up until September, workers were quite reluctant to come back to the city centre. But you see that weekend activity was almost 80% recovery. And nighttime as well was around 40% here. So I guess the nighttime here is really interesting because it tells us that it's not just workers staying in town for a dinner or a drink after work, but it's also here, the fact that nighttime is above workers tells us that it's people coming into the city centre just for the evening and just to enjoy its leisure aspect. So I would say, if anything, we're far from seeing city's role decline. That doesn't mean we won't see any changes, and the depth of these changes very much depends on what happens to the workers' trend here. And I guess that leaves us with more questions than answers on the future of work from home, for instance, and I'd be more than happy to address them in the discussion section, but I leave it here for now. Thank you.
Wonderful, Martin. Thank you very much. Thank you. So finally, last but not least, Michael.
Well, thank you very much for having me as part of this panel. And I think that the difficulty in coming last is that most of the points, in fact, I think basically all of them have been made, and I'm sort of surprised, but I think that in a non-coordinated panel that we're so much on the same page, and I find it very interesting that we've converged to many of the similar viewpoints. So I want to report on some reflections that are in a paper that Rich Florida, Andres Rodriguez-Posse, and I wrote together. And like I think all of the other panelists, we're dealing with a real-time situation and trying to interpolate between what's been happening in the short run and some speculations about the long run. So this point was already made, I think, which is that, you know, we've had both pandemics and technology shocks in the past, and neither of them ever killed city. So I grew up of the generation where, you know, in the 1990s when The Economist wrote The Death of Distance and Cities Are Over, that you know, we were all taken with that hypothesis, and which of course turned out to be dead wrong. And if one looks over the longer run, every time there's sort of an improvement in the technologies by which we cover distance, and there are predictions that distance is dead and we're all gonna spread out. And what happens is that there's in fact the opposite effect, which is a kind of an indirect effect of making distance cheaper, is that it actually enhances the ability to produce economic complexity, which in turn has a concentration effect. Now, this time could be different. The shock of this pandemic and going to Zoom overnight might be different. And so, you know, we might want to think about it seriously rather than just write it off because it doesn't line up with history. What Andres and Rich and I were thinking of were a set of sort of push and pull forces, which the other panelists have already talked about. And push and pull forces at two geographical scales, like the way that Max laid out, of we might say intra-urban or intra-metropolitan, and then at a city system or inter-metropolitan level. We might also think about two sort of broad groups, which are households and firms. So a couple of levels and a couple of groups of actors. And we might think about whether households want to be farther apart and have more space in the long run, or whether they will have a reinforced desire to be close to work and urban amenities. And I'm speaking about once the pandemic is over. We might think about for firms, whether in the long run, the forces that have been very powerful in recent years, notably for knowledge-based firms, which are very powerful agglomeration effects, whether they will hold up. And building on the last theme that was introduced by Valentin, the question of the complementarities or the multiplier effects between the economic core and other kinds of businesses that are in the local non-tradable sector. So these are just a set of questions, right? We have a bunch of push and pull forces that we have data for 9 months from, and it's, in my opinion, very hard to draw any definitive conclusions. However they work out, what I think we wanna keep our eyes on as we come out of the pandemic and go to some more durable post-pandemic pattern is, are there some kind of new equilibrium pathways for urban space and the urban system, and are they substantially different from what we had prior to the pandemic? For me, that's the sort of overall a question. Other panelists have already noted this, you know, the workforce, work divides into different categories. The one that's really gone to work from home is knowledge-based work that differs across cities. Very knowledge-based cities, it hits the 50% mark. In many other cities, it's more in the 20-30% percent zone, and that of course has very big effects on one city versus another. My guess, I think, or our guess that in our paper is that for the knowledge-based economy, that it's not going to be the end of going to the office, but that it will be some kind of set of new hybrid work patterns combined with relatively minor household choice adjustments, meaning residential adjustments. So I think it's a reasonable sort of speculation that we might go from a 5-day week to a more variegated week. We academics have been doing that for a long time, but I think it will hit many other parts of the economy. There will be, I think, on the margin, a group of people or households with high status or independent status that can permanently relocate and do occasional travel to cities. But I think, at least when Rich and Andres and I were trying to think it through, we feel that there will be not enormous effects on residential choice. Now, within the metropolitan area, I think that's harder to figure out. There will be clearly some people who, if they go to more hybrid work, more of their time, they're going to want more space at home. And they're not going to be at the office every day. So that could change where they locate at an intra-metropolitan scale. On the other hand, there's some intriguing journalism and intriguing sociology, which suggests that social scarring might go in the other direction, meaning that a lot of people in suburbs have actually found the lockdown to be more painful and more boring than people who got locked down and who happened to be living in dense urban neighborhoods. Because even though most things have been shut in dense urban neighborhoods, to put it bluntly, on the whole, there's still more to walk around and look at when you can't go to a restaurant, when you're in a big city, and more and more sort of on the street feeling. And a lot of people have been very scarred by actually being in low density neighborhoods during the lockdown. We don't know what the balance of those two forces is. It's a behavioral question that we just don't know much about yet. Agglomeration economies, I think most of the panelists that we're agreeing that agglomeration economies for firms are unlikely to be killed off by the pandemic. And that's not only for the basic core economy, but obviously for the urban entertainment and cultural and fun economy. Those are things with economies of scales, central place functions. There's obviously a pent up desire to travel and thing and see things that is now occurring. So it's in our opinion likely that the superstar metropolitan areas will continue to dominate urban cities, as urban systems, as they have been increasingly in the last 40 years. And that's going to leave roughly intact the problem of interregional inequalities that is a major problem in almost every developed country at this point. Turning to a kind of the level of the city itself, or kind of the lived city, we know that we've been suffering through, prior to the pandemic, a major commercial gentrification wave and a sort of a residential gentrification wave. And there will be changes probably in the demand for commercial space and for office space. And there was already an ongoing retail apocalypse from the turn to buying on the internet. There's gonna be some, I think, fairly important impacts on the on urban land use and the demand for urban property. And that could lead to a set of chain effects of possibly repurposing urban spaces, notably high streets and commercial districts, where we don't know, for example, whether office space demand will decline, whether that will unleash the possibility of transforming it into residential space, which would in turn ease gentrification pressures. We don't know whether the residential apocalypse will be responded to, for example, by repurposing commercial spaces into different kinds of live and work spaces and other kinds of interactions between the functional uses of the city. All of this, I think, is a really interesting set of phenomena to keep our eyes on. And I think just to conclude, there's of course the role of policy. A number of the other panelists noted phenomena like the collapse in demand for public transit. Massive investments have been made in public transit in many cities around the world. And I think the open question is whether to get through the pandemic period and its very painful, let's say 3 to 4 year adjustment period, whether urban public space, urban transit, those kinds of things will be allowed to collapse and deteriorate. in which case we could have what a sort of a doom cycle like we had in the 70s and 80s of the 20th century of deteriorating urban amenities, and that would produce the pressures for people to flee the cities if cities became dirty, dangerous, and uncomfortable again. Or on the other hand, whether there will be policies to maintain the enormous accumulated amenity value of cities that we've seen as part of the recent cycle of urban economic development, so as to get through this painful period and then allow the cities to recapture some of their luster. And that's really open, it's an open question about urban policy and obviously public expenditure priorities in a period where there's gonna be a lot of competition for public expenditures. So lots of speculation, and thanks for listening.
Wonderful, Michael, thank you so much. So what I'm gonna do now is we've got loads of questions and there are questions are still coming in, and I would encourage you to continue putting them in. So what I'm gonna do is give you three in a group, and then sort of you can answer the ones which you feel sort of confident to answer, because I think that way we'll sort of leave the least time mucking around on Zoom, muting and unmuting ourselves. So the first question is explicitly focused for Shauna from Donna Carmichael, who's a PhD student at the LSE. Hello, Donna. And she's right working about private capital markets and institutional investment in real estate. So this is quite a difficult question. But she's saying a distinct shift from residential real estate acquisition away from major cities into gateway smaller cities and suburbs. Private investment firms are reporting a huge wave of interest in moving to smaller cities. She's asking for comment on that. Another question for whoever wants to take it, it's from Craig Johnson at the Wales Centre for Public Policy. If you're advising a policymaker thinking about office space, urban planning and or public transport investment in 2021, what would you recommend? I mean, Michael, you touched on this a little bit. Carry on as you intended, adapt for blended office home working, or rip up the plans and start again. And the third question is sort of, you know, similar, which is, will the pandemic change what citizens demand from the urban realm? This is from Matthew DeSantis. Will there be a push for more public spaces not contingent on commerce? Will there be a rethinking of base level conditions we demand from our interiors when the promise and resources of the city have been offloaded into our homes? So three great questions. Shauna, I'm gonna ask you to go first, if that's okay.
Sure. Okay, well, I'll start with the first one, which I think is probably also the hardest one. This question about, and not that I necessarily want to be giving free advice to real estate investors, but thinking about where to invest and thinking about, more importantly, patterns of movement and patterns in terms of where people want to live. I showed a slide with lots of newspaper headlines, and there are so many more of them. You could fill up a book of newspaper headlines suggesting that cities are emptying out because people are moving away. In New York City, there was an interesting study done very early on that showed particularly people in the Upper East and Upper West Side, about 3 or 4% of the population actually just picked up and left. And most of them went to their secondary homes. So I think that there certainly is a growing market for secondary homes. We see that in Toronto too. I don't know. I think you see that in London also, a growing market for secondary homes that are a couple of hours away from the very big urban centers. These are places where only people who are already very established in their careers, who are already able to work remotely, or who are, you know, have independent wealth and don't need to work. But for most people, it's actually not a reality and not a possibility. I think it was Max who also mentioned the fact that we simply aren't building enough housing, enough residential units in these areas in order to be able to accommodate. I like to give, you know, in Canada, 1/3 of the total population of the country lives in one of the three biggest city regions, either Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver. If as a country we saw huge shifts away from these three big cities to some of our smaller centers, which in fact the smaller centers in Ontario, in the province of Ontario where I live, are growing in many cases at a faster sort of proportional rate, but actually the absolute numbers in terms of growth are so small relative to the absolute numbers of people moving into the Toronto region, for instance. So we might see 15-20% growth in a smaller municipality that's building a lot of housing. That would be pretty extraordinary. In the city of Toronto, we're seeing much smaller percentage growth, but we're actually seeing our city region grow by 100,000 people per year. For any other place to accommodate the growth of a mid-sized city in the space of a year is just about unheard of. So I think that there will be some growth and some movement, whether it's sort of new family formation, which is what my colleague Richard Florida talks about when he talks about who's moving out of the city. And it's often because of affordability issues. And then it's also on the sort of income and privilege side of things. If I could also just briefly sort of touch on the third question around, will the pandemic change what citizens demand from the public realm? Yes. And in fact, this is one of the first things we saw was shifts in how we use public realm really, really quickly, right? So we saw in New York, in Toronto, in Bogota, we saw more and faster implementation of bike lanes. So creating space for people who didn't want to take or didn't feel safe taking transit, and huge uptake in bike lanes and the expediting of spaces for bike lanes. We saw in Vilnius, we saw that they opened up their square to commercial sort of cafes to be able to have outdoor dining so that these small businesses could stay afloat. Many of these weren't new initiatives, they were planned, but they were expedited because of the pandemic. But we also see just the grave need for more public space, for green space, for outdoor space, which is considered safe, whereas indoor spaces aren't, especially in places, in cities where 50% or more of the population lives in high-rise apartments. We need to figure out ways to create safe spaces. Now, And parks and public realm is one of the best ways. And we don't need 30% of our land to be given over to streets that just have, that are, advantage people in their private automobiles. We need to think about this. And cities, big cities, are making these transitions. But absolutely, we should demand more from public realm. And we're seeing some pretty amazing rapid changes. In some ways, these are some of the easiest changes to make quickly.
Wonderful, Shona. Thank you very much. I'm going to turn to Max purely because you're next on my screen.
Thanks. Let me say a little bit to add to what Shona was saying to Donna, and then I want to touch on Craig's question. That 3% figure from New York is really striking because the best evidence I've seen for the UK is like the same number. So there's a study that I think tracks people by their phones. So actually seeing where people were as opposed to, less robust methods. And they're basically about 3% of London's population seem to have left before lockdown. So these were people sort of anticipating where they could go. So, I think that tells you a certain amount about who's moving. Beyond that, it's quite hard to tell. So these could be people, like Shona says, who have their second homes to go to, but it could equally be people who have parents who live outside London and they've gone home to stay with mum and dad. So there could be quite a large, cross-section of people within that 3%. I mean, the other piece of evidence we have for London is looking at what's happening to, to rents data, and that, London rents are going down, but they're going down in central London districts. And that, again, that's a very kind of high-end section of the rental market. Actually, rents in outer London seem to be behaving like the rest of the country and going up now, which is, I think, partly reflecting kind of bottlenecks in buying and selling. So the sort of urban exodus that people have talked about is, possibly there, but seems very, very kind of niche. I think that kind of relates to my answer to Craig's question, which would be, I guess, two things. I mean, the kind of best guess, I think, is like Michael's best guess, which is that we're going to see more kind of hybrid ways of using office space. And some of those already exist. Some of them are basically going to be distributed from sectors which were very presenteeist to ones that will become a bit more relaxed about whether people are going to have to be in every day. I think the other part of it is, if you're a policymaker, you need to be asking your, employers and employers groups and property groups what they think is going on. Because if we're, if we're right, and this is a period of experimentation, it's not obvious that anybody knows how this is going to go. And it's certainly not clear that employers have the best understanding of what they need. So some of this is actually going to be helping that discovery process to happen. and avoiding doing things which, you know, are lead to kind of irrecoverable changes in urban, you know, in the urban fabric. So, I mean, part of that is avoiding the kind of infrastructure doom loop that Michael mentioned, but there are other kind of doom loops that might be triggered around, you know, converting all your offices and shops into houses when you don't need to do that. And I think it's, you know, way too early to be moving in that direction.
Fantastic. Valentin?
Sure, I'd be happy to pick up on the second question. I guess in terms of public policy perspective, I guess there's two things to focus on probably. One is to help cities shift towards more flexible types of use, and the other one is to help make cities more livable. And so on the first one for office space, for instance, I guess the question is on the future of the CBD, and I guess the role of the like policy making is to help adapt these areas towards more multi-purpose model and mixed use, for instance, and also adapt to maybe co-working, which will respond to demand in these areas. But then once again, even if we see demand decrease for office space or like traditional office space in these places, with like some companies have already announced they wouldn't come back to city centers, I guess we can also rely on market phenomenons where property market rents will decrease, and then these places will just be used by other people. And so we can maybe expect more startups and more entrepreneurs and more independent businesses to rise in these places. Then on the question around urban planning, I think once again, it's all about making cities more livable. And like Shauna just mentioned before, we've all experienced during this lockdown what it feels like to live in a city which is much more livable, with more space for pedestrian, green city, better air quality. And so I guess in terms of investment, it's all about investing in green spaces, investing in maybe enlarging space for pedestrian or car-free zones in city centers, for instance. And then the third element around public transport is also a crucial one. And that's because, well, first of all, because confidence towards public transport has really reduced as a result of the pandemic. And I guess it will take a public campaign to restore confidence and convince people that it's safe again to use public transport. And that's crucial for air quality, for instance. And we're just about to publish a research on air quality. And in a nutshell, what it shows is that air quality improved during lockdown, but it bounced back air pollution bounced back as soon as restrictions were released. And that's because people use their car much more than before. And so there's a lot to be done in terms of disincentivizing people from using their cars. And one of these things is also to invest in public transport and increase accessibility towards the city centers without having to use a car.
Thank you, Michael.
So if I were to be put in the position of giving advice, I would say three things right now. One is on the big question of offices, housing, and all that, I would say to policymakers, wait. It's too early. We don't know enough. These are huge, long-term, sunk cost issues. Let's start talking about it again in a year, and in the meantime, gather data. On the second, which is the repurposing of high streets and even other commercial streets, that's a long-term trend. We are having a combination of the retail apocalypse predates the pandemic. And even beyond that, there's, I think, a legitimate concern in notably many of the world superstar cities of a kind of, you know, well, I'm going to be opinionated here, but sort of a boring chain store homogenization of everything on the streets. And citizens groups were already concerned with something like having a more diverse ecosystem of stores, which were being killed off by commercial rents even before the pandemic. So there is some kind of opportunity space to join the crisis induced by the pandemic with the ongoing retail apocalypse and to think creatively. I think that's I know several cities that were already doing that, And I think it's an absolutely a very interesting space for policymakers to move right into right now. And in the third, which is the sort of overall quality of urban life story, that's what I would call, I have a fear of a doom cycle that I mentioned in my last slide in certain places, notably in the United States, because of its tradition of local public finance. Cities are incredibly vulnerable right now to having their budgets collapse. That contrasts with other countries, notably for, you know, my other country, like France, where we don't have that. And where prior to the pandemic, for example, our mayor here invested spectacularly in a bicycling system and in pushing cars out of the city. And of course, in just a you know, cycle of, albeit gentrifying, but amenity improvement. And there's no question that cities that already have that, they should do counter-cyclical spending to not allow their acquired amenity base to be ruined by the short-term crisis, and to set off that cycle of fleeing the city as happened a half century ago. That's what I'm worried about in America. Less worried about in continental Europe. Britain, as always, is probably somewhere in between those two cases in terms of risk.
That's great. I'm going to take three questions in a row, which are all focused on the environment in some way, because that seems to be, that's coming up a lot. So, I mean, the first question from Anonymous was, how do you think COVID will impact cities' ability to mitigate against climate change? And I guess underpinning that for me certainly is, you know, are we going to get distracted by other sort of important things, or will we sort of lose resources? Emma Hamlin says, could the pandemic open paths to economic degrowth? Has degrowth been a part of post-COVID recovery discussion outside of a reduced work week? And Adam Brown asks a sort of interesting question. Given we're in the middle of trying to redesign our urban systems to reach carbon neutrality, isn't the question not about what we think will happen, but about what this forced experiment tells us about what we can feasibly make happen in reality? So who wants to go first? If we have any sort of volunteers for people who are, or we can go in the usual order. Shauna, I'm afraid it's going to be the usual order, but I'll reverse it next time.
I was searching around on my desk because for the longest time, I had this printout of a graph that showed what happened in China back in April. So before most of North America and Western Europe had even gone into like the real throes of the pandemic, many Chinese cities were emerging from the worst of it. And actually we didn't listen, or we said, oh, it'll be different here. But in fact, they had, you know, I showed the slide where all the mobility falls off a cliff and cars and walking come back and transit stays down. It looked like that in Chinese cities back in April. They knew it, they had the data, they knew that intention to buy a car had gone up significantly, and they knew that the amount of people driving instead of taking transit had gone up significantly. And they knew that they had to find a way to get more people back onto public transit if they were also going to help address some of these sort of climate issues and also congestion issues. And we didn't listen, because by August, September, we saw the exact same things in North American cities, in New York, which has very low rates of car ownership. Intention to buy a vehicle had again gone through the roof. And so we didn't totally learn that lesson. I think we still need to go back there. We need to understand how to ensure that public transit is safer, because it also is far less sort of environmentally damaging. I know there are some people who suggest, well, if we can continue in this kind of work from home environment, that actually this might reduce emissions. And I've seen conflicting sort of studies and estimates. So one study says, absolutely, you work from home, you don't need to drive as much, emissions go down. But another one that says, you work from home, but you decided to move out of the city or even out of the city region. And when you have to do your errands or when you have to go into your office, you're actually going to be driving more. So you might be taking fewer trips, but driving longer on each trip, and therefore producing greater emissions. And so I like what Michael said about, you know, we don't actually know. We're collecting a lot of information. We need even more data. It's too soon to know, but we do know that on top of a pandemic, we have an urban crisis, we have a climate crisis, we have an equity crisis. You know, is there a magic, a silver bullet to address all of them? And what does it look like? I think in Paris, the mayor has been doing her absolute level best to make some of these really difficult shifts, and they're difficult politically, and they cost money, and they cost some social capital too. And yet I think there's this understanding that at the end of the day, if we can start to make these shifts, we'll actually be better off in the long run. But those are hard choices to make.
Great, Max.
I'm going to try and take the first and third question simultaneously. And again, this is going to kind of echo some of what Shauna said. I mean, on the sort of positives that I see are that we now have this, you know, we have this enormous and very rapidly unfolding crisis that, you know, governments and public institutions were, you know, able to respond to at scale and at speed. And some of the specific responses and the kind of, you know, the scale of money spent and the speed of rollout creates really important precedents for similar, you know, systemic crises like the climate crisis. I mean, the sort of possibility scope and the set of precedents that have been created, I think that's really important. And, you know, it becomes much harder to say this kind of thing can't be done when there's a pressing enough need. On the other side, I think some of the trends are going in directions which are less positive. So, you know, on the one hand, we have, you know, lots of spending by cities on cycling and walking infrastructure, kind of emergency urbanism that's gone in. On the other hand, as Shauna and Michael have said, you know, driving has just kind of bumped straight back up again. Part of the response to that, I think, is kind of Michael's point about countercyclical spending. I think another important part of it is actually, you know, an effective public health response and creating confidence in that. Now, the vaccines are going to help with that, but as long as people don't feel that they can safely use public transport, this is not going to happen. And this is also a kind of important lesson for future pandemics, I think. The other part of it which troubles me is, you know, Shauna's point about energy use. The study that I've seen looks at kind of energy use in offices versus energy use in homes. And there's basically a kind of one-to-one shift. So there's no drop in consumption if you, you know, go from, you know, spending your working day in an office to spending it in a sort of spare room in your house, if you have a spare room in your house. You know, there's no net cut in energy use. And that, I think, is quite tricky. And that, you know, that tells us something about how much we still have to do about finding ways of working which are, you know, are going to kind of cut carbon emissions.
Fantastic. Valentin.
Yes, on the question around climate change, I think, and it has been said before, but to many extents, we can think of this pandemic as a sort of first experiment, almost a rehearsal to prepare ourselves to the bigger challenge, which is climate change. And I'm thinking of this cartoon I saw at some point, which showed three waves. And I think one was Brexit, the other one was the COVID pandemic, and the third one, the huge wave coming upon us, was climate change. And I think as a lesson from this crisis, what we've learned is that when there's something we consider to be an emergency, then policymakers are, you know, in some ways able to find a way to invest billions and forget about debt for a second, which I think was quite an interesting lesson. But then there's also, on the other side, I suppose this crisis, and this was mentioned in the question, this crisis also distracts us from the core fight against climate change. And air pollution is a good example of that, although it's not directly related to climate change, but it's environmental issues more generally. But what we saw is that in 2020, a number of cities were meant to implement clean air zones, which are areas in city centres where the most polluting cars are being charged. And many places have decided, at best, to delay clean air zones, and at worst, to cancel them on the grounds that air quality improved this year. And what we see is that it's not the case, and air quality has improved very briefly, but then came back to pre-lockdown levels. So it has delayed the whole process of fighting against air pollution, which is a shame. And then I suppose on the flip side, what this crisis also entails is that it creates opportunities, especially in terms of job creation, to address the issue of climate change and global warming by creating more jobs in the green economy. And we know that many of the jobs that have been lost in many places can also, you know, these people can be upskilled and retrained for like decarbonizing homes, for instance. And so there's a whole lot of opportunities in the green economy which can, you know, come as a result of this crisis.
Great, Michael.
Well, I have just one point to add, which I think goes in the direction of all the other panelists, which is so this pandemic is likely to be the first in a set of sharp shocks to city. Climate change will unfold probably as sharp climate incidents. And most of my like ecologist friends tell me that we're likely to see more of these zoonotic diseases in the 21st century because at a planetary level, the human wild interface is constantly being altered. So the good news is, you know, that we're getting a vaccine done really fast, and I'm not trying to be like, you know, scare everybody. But the point is, I think we should think about the 21st century as cities having probably a succession of shocks. And the question sort of goes back to my my worry about amenities and cyclical, counter-cyclical, or knock-on effects, which is, are we going to react to the shocks with what we might call more publicly oriented, inclusive solutions? Those are a bit corny words, but I think they're actually kind of important for this moment. Or are we going to react with forms of what you might call fortress urbanism, and the degradation of public space and those doom cycles? I'm very haunted by them from the past. And I think this is the moment that we really must think about all of this in a very concerted fashion. I'm booting up an article I think I read in the New York Times about some like climate change hardened new luxury tower that went up in Miami Beach. You know, where the idea was literally we have a fortress. You know, the tower is like, you know, 10 feet above the floodplain. And it'll flood around us like in some, you know, some Hollywood apocalypse movie. Now that's okay, that's a bit of a lurid image, but as a kind of a metaphor, I think it's a pretty good one for an overarching challenge that public policy faces at the moment.
I was almost feeling optimistic after Valentin said that in an emergency, governments discovered they could act, and then you come in with we're all
going to be too pessimistic, but just to say we have the possibility of doing this in a more inclusive way and dealing with some of the socio-spatial inequalities that the panel has been concerned with. But there is a bit of a fork in the road.
So we've actually, Michael, we've had a question which I think is sort of, you know, largely directed to you, which is from Jonathan Sapsed, presumably at Newcastle. Could we see a slow buzz form appearing in the smaller cities and rural towns as hipsters move out for the bigger homes but still want some of the sort of interaction they're used to? So we're going to take that question specifically at Michael, and also three other questions which are loosely themed around sort of technology. So Rostafarzan Farzan says, I'm interested in the role of technology and the digital gap during the pandemic. So I think she focused on the sort of inequality and access to technology, and, you know, how the reliance on technology has increased because of the pandemic and the sort of implications of that in terms of sort of, you know, digital gaps and digital divides. We also had a question here from Ray Brundage, who's retired in Kentucky. And I just think it's magnificent that we can run events where we have people from Greece, Kentucky, all over the world sort of attending. So Ray Brundage says, do you anticipate the pandemic effect to compound the effect of AI and robotics? And then the final one is maybe a little bit more, a little bit less forward focus, but this is from David King in the UK Cities and Local Growth Unit. Do commercial landlords have the evidence to sell the productivity gains of office work once social distancing is not required? So this is, I mean, Max, I know, would be sort of, you know, good to answer this question, for example, but really, you know, our agglomerate, do we have evidence about the sort of productivity gains of office work, basically? So I'm going to start off with Michael, specifically if you could take the slow buzz question.
Well, actually, I thought Max was the expert on hipster urbanism here, but I'll try it anyway. So I mean, actually, that question is one that, you know, we've struggled with in my field of economic geography for a long time, which is, what is this sort of what we might call the seedbed process by which, you know, new sort of clusters of creative, innovative people get going in new places? In a sense, it's that kind of issue that we tried to deal with for a long time. And the truth is, we don't know much about it in a systematic way. We know a lot about what happens when you already have a group of creative, innovative, you know, firms and industries and so on, and those processes going. And we know a lot about the kind of circular and cumulative dynamics that lead those communities to be successful in an ongoing way. How new ones break off and happen in new places is one of the most mysterious questions in urbanism and economic geography. And we know about the big ones that break off, like when you have a giant technological revolution and Silicon Valley appears, as it were, out of sort of on the left coast and changes the American urban system as a result. But these smaller scale ones, like, you know, small sort of specialized communities of people, or what we might call like niche communities, I wish we knew more about it. We do have some stories and cases, by the way. So I think it's not impossible, but I'm not sure I can say much more about what you would do to make it happen.
Great. We'll move on to the next hipster urbanist, Valentin, for answers to.
Yes. Well, I think the question around the digital divide and the digital gap is really crucial, because we've seen that over the lockdown. We may think that work from home is inclusive, but I don't think it is, because it's excluding a large chunk of the population, which it's not just about having access to broadband, for instance, but it's about being able to use it as much as we would do in the office, for instance. And so I guess on this, there's something else to talk about when we talk about technology, is whether or not we think technology will allow us to work from home properly. And when you think of it, Skype was invented in 2003, for instance, and it hasn't changed that much since then, and it still hasn't replaced face-to-face interaction and everything we need to, in my opinion, work as best as we can. And so I think there's a question here around, have we reached the maximum potential capacity for technology to help us do what we need to do for work? Because I don't feel like, unless we do holograms, for instance, if that's the next innovation, but I feel like in the current state, it's not enough to allow us to work as much as we would in the office.
Thanks, Max.
I want to try and take the kind of slow buzz question. I'm sure I've seen this movie. I mean, this feels like a kind of classic, you know, plot line of many films where, you know, people move from the big city and try and recreate it in some, you know, small town American setting. I mean, like Michael says, I think we have a better idea of how this works in kind of small places close to big cities. And like you said, it's a kind of, you know, there's a lot of serendipity at the start, and then it's a kind of cumulative process. But I think, you know, a lot of the explanation is through kind of social and professional networks. People get to hear about a place and they like it, and the kind of the buzz builds and they move there. It's much harder to figure out, you know, how this happens or might happen from a kind of policymaker's point of view if you want to do it somewhere that's quite far away from a big city. And actually the kind of policy lever that you normally reach for is a kind of at-scale relocation. So, you know, I've been doing some work with some LSE colleagues about, you know, what happened when we moved a big chunk of the BBC out of London to, you know, part of Greater Manchester. Now that's not moving it to the middle of nowhere by any extent, but it is the kind of at scale move that I think is probably required to build this stuff, if you're not going to rely on the kind of cumulative process that Michael was talking about. On David's question about office productivity, I mean, the short answer is, yeah, we do have this evidence, or rather kind of academics have this evidence. There's a bunch of really interesting recent studies looking at kind of microgeographies and innovation and productivity within, you know, research labs, co-working spaces, accelerators, kind of stylized settings where there's a lot of productivity. There's a big literature looking at, you know, agglomeration economies inside firms and how much that's due to kind of worker matching and worker interaction. And then there's another big literature looking at that at the kind of city scale. Now, whether kind of landlords and commercial real estate have that information and can act on it is a question that I don't have the answer to. But I mean, we are in a kind of, you know, we are in a kind of experimentation point, and there is a scenario where, you know, at the moment these advantages exist. If everyone starts working at home and stops working in the offices, those advantages are still out there, but they've effectively gone away. So some of this is kind of endogenous to what people decide to do. They're not kind of permanent advantages that are always going to be there if people change their behavior around it. So some of this comes back to this earlier question about, you know, how we work with policymakers and what advice we give them and, you know, what we suggest they do.
Great. Shauna, final hipster.
Oh, thank you. I just will really quickly talk about the sort of the smaller towns piece and particularly some examples I've seen from the US. I think one of the things we might see, and we are seeing a bit of, is increased competition amongst the smaller towns to attract talent and activity, right? So we're going to see, you know, some kind of a resurgence of incentives. There are a couple of US cities, I think Tulsa, Oklahoma is one of them. It's not necessarily a tiny place, but they are offering a relocation stipend of something like $10,000 to individuals who relocate there. My kids thought it'd be a great idea if we could just say we were going and get the money. And I think you probably have to do a little bit more than just say you're going. But that's, they're not the only ones that are offering this kind of personal financial incentive for to attract household moves, particularly for remote workers. And I think we're just going to see more of that kind of intercity competition amongst smaller places. In terms of the, you know, tech and the digital gap during the pandemic, I think we all, four out of five of us work in the education sector, where all of our courses, for the most part, I mean, in the social sciences, have all gone remote since in Canada since March. And we are not going back into the physical classroom anytime soon here. All of our students have had to transfer over to working remotely. And this has caused, again, sort of great injustices and imbalances. First, for students who are located in the Toronto region, there are some kinds of supports where the university and schools even will offer an iPad for use. There are some public-private partnerships where the telecoms firms are offering up, you know, equipment to students. But this is an enormous challenge for all sort of educators, and it's not exclusive to people in education. But there's going to be a real challenge for people who don't have that access to the technology. They are being left behind. And there needs to be more done on that. And then the last thing I'll say on the tech and digital piece, I mean, if you look at platform firms and food delivery and restaurants, one of the best ways to keep restaurants in business is to pivot to having a sort of a digital, an online menu and takeout and delivery, which for the most part, restaurants are relying on delivery companies. They simply don't have the right logistics networks or the right tech systems in order to do this themselves. And it's hugely expensive. It may not be worth their while. We're starting to see some regulations put in place by both, you know, provincial or state governments and local governments around reducing the amount of commissions in order to ensure that this sort of this digital opportunity can actually help to support the recovery.
That's wonderful. An optimistic note, I think, if we're in some respects, at least we can do something. Because, you know, so the final, you know, I'm sorry, I haven't got through everyone's questions. We have tried our hardest, but there's still loads. But a lot of people are talking about policy and talking about this as being a sort of inflection point, thinking about how we can sort of, you know, build back better, to put it in a, you know, to give it one phrase. So we're out of time, unfortunately. I want to say thank you so much to our speakers, who I think have just been fascinating. A virtual round of applause for you guys. Thank you very much to everyone who's attended. Thank you very much to the LSE Inequalities Institute for organizing it. I'm sure if you have further questions, and there's loads of specific questions and stuff which I haven't been able to get to, I'm sure you can email all the speakers and they'll be happy to sort of field your questions. But thank you very much for attending. Thank you.